You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. I feel like I should introduce myself just because it's been donkey years since I've actually been on, so this is like a real introduction. My name is Ed Song. I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara. And this other guy you know, this is Coy O'Neill, an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. What's up, Coy?
Just trying to stay out of the heat, Ed.
Yeah, are you working hard this summer?
Not as hard as I should be. But, you know, it's summer, so academics just do nothing over the summer, right?
Yeah, we've probably made this joke before, but, like, one of my least favorite things is meeting people around town, say, like, parents from Eli's school or whatever, and they're like, ah, you must be glad summer's here. And I'm like, if you only knew. Like, summer is the busiest time of year for us.
I mean, it's, I will admit there is something to that, but it's we have much more control over our own schedules.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. And that's true during the year, too. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's like, do most people, so the great benefit of an academic career precisely is that control. Because there's a way in which you're an independent contractor. I mean, you just have autonomy over everything that you do outside of the odd committee meeting or, you know, administrative responsibility that you have. But, like, we generally set our own schedules and, you know, and that's awesome. But on the other hand, that also means that, like, it's 9 o'clock at night and I'm working.
Right.
I don't know. Does, like, your average person work at night?
I think it depends on the job. So my neighbor is a welder. Or was a welder, and he's now working in a factory, and he works evening shifts, night shifts sometimes.
Well, no, yeah, okay. I guess I mean by that, so work in a normal day job. So I understand the idea of an evening shift, but then they're not working during the day.
Sure, sure.
So I guess, I mean, the thing with an academic, it's like there's always a little bit more work that you can do.
Right, and work tends to go home with us in a way.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just wondering, like, your average person, how many of them take their work home with them?
Yeah, I think that just depends on the job. Certainly when I worked retail, I never took it home with me because register stayed in the, you know, store.
Yeah.
But you know, when I lived on a ranch, you were always at home working because that's where you worked. So.
And so what are your big summer projects or plans?
I always have big plans at the start of the summer, and then they don't always come to fruition. This summer, a colleague and I received a grant to host a reading group on campus. So that's kind of our big during the summer activity. And then we are working on a grant proposal for some other stuff down the road.
Great. So, what's the book, or have you chosen it yet?
It's actually part of the grant. Part of this particular reading group was chosen for us. It's a reading packet that was put together years ago called The Founder's Philosophy of Education. So it's Jefferson, Franklin, Washington, and who's the other one? Benjamin Rush, I think, all just kind of selections from their writings on education and what it should look like in White Matters. This is a camp for teachers. So reading.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great.
Teachers. So.
Like K through 12 teachers.
Or administrators. We even have a few homeschooling parents in there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. But not non-academics, not college professors.
No. How about you? What do you have going on this summer?
Both my wife and I, so Felicia is finishing, she has a manuscript due to the publisher in August, and I'm furiously trying to get work done on my book and get a proposal out by the end of the summer. So there's that. And then, yeah, and a lot of church stuff, actually. So we're going to Orlando for the Free Methodist General Conference, which is like our big quadrennial international meeting of Free Methodists. I'm a delegate. And so that's going to be like 12-hour days voting on stuff. And
Now, are you guys going to have a big vote like the United Methodist Conference had up in St. Louis this year?
So, yeah, no, not those kinds of issues. You're alluding to issues regarding sexuality, right? Yeah, so let me say something about Free Methodism. Free Methodism is a branch of Methodism that broke off from mainline Methodism in the late 19th century. I mean, actually, I think our founder, B.T. Roberts, was like excommunicated because we were abolitionists. We were abolitionists and we cared about like social inequality. Like there was this practice of like renting pews, you know, and
sure.
Poor people sat in back. And I think, mainline Methodists didn't like that. And so we kind of split off. But it's a self-consciously evangelical denomination. The thing that's really amazing about it to me is that it's evangelical. But in its bones, it's sort of committed to a concern about issues of justice in the world. It also happens to be egalitarian. And I think it only started ordaining women in the 70s. But again, the founder was like writing about these issues in the 19th century. Yeah, so it's awesome. Sort of exploring Free Methodism has actually been really, really significant for me. And the Free Methodist Church in Southern California is amazing. Like when we go denominational meetings, we're organized by conferences, mm-hmm. and our conference is in Southern California, and you know it's really amazing, the people. I guess it was also sort of formed by the holiness movement through a big part of the 20th century,
right?
And anyways, so to answer your question, our big issues, we have three bishops. Sort of three equal bishops oversee the United States. And then actually a number of Free Methodist churches outside of the United States that aren't big enough to establish their own conference or can't establish their own conference for political reasons, if you know what I mean. So, and so all three of our current bishops are stepping down all at once, which has never happened before. And I think that was a little bit of a statement that they were trying to make about the need for new leadership. And so we're electing three new bishops. And so that's kind of a big deal. So that's the big deal.
Okay.
But, you know, related to that are issues of race and diversity. And it's kind of cool. The nominees that we have for bishop are really, really remarkable people. They include some persons of color. They include some women. And I don't think there's ever been anything except for a white man bishop in the history of our denomination. So it kind of portends to be a little historic.
Fair enough.
And then, you know, so I'll be there doing church conference stuff. Our family's going. My daughter, who's 14, is going to be doing like a leadership track. And then I think my wife and my son are going to be running around doing the theme park thing.
Is it Disney World and what have you?
Yeah, yeah. And then after, though, when it ends, we're going to sort of stay the weekend and go to Universal Studios. And
sure.
Drink butter beer.
Which I have not had, but does not sound appealing even a little bit.
Well, so are you a Harry Potter person?
I am a Harry Potter person, but yeah, I just butter in beer doesn't do it for me.
Or do you like cream soda?
Yeah, yeah. It's all right.
I mean, it's kind of like a cream soda and a root beer.
Right.
It's not, I mean, like, we've been to the Universal Studios in Hollywood. I took my daughter as a reward for something. And, we ran around the Hogsmeade there and got the butter beer. And,
sure.
Like, it was cool. Like, it's not like I find myself just on a random day craving a butter beer. But, you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's not disgusting. Apparently, there's like a new, the Star Wars land has opened in Disneyland here in California. That's been the big rage out here. And so, like, they sell the blue milk.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, blue milk and green milk. I can't remember where the green milk appeared, but there's green milk in the trilogy, too. But they sell blue milk and green milk. And I think opinions are divisive on the blue milk.
I have had neither of those, so...
You haven't had Bantha milk?
No.
I don't know, whatever it is. Anyways, so that's what we have going on. I see in our notes that you have a quiz for me.
Yeah, so just three short questions to kind of dig into our topic a little bit. So when imagine, and these are all scenarios that have happened at one point or another, it's an evening here in Bolivar, Missouri, and it's, you know, 90 degrees with 95% humidity, and I'm out mowing the lawn, and my wife is inside reading books to the kids, helping them brush their teeth and getting them ready for bed. Which of us is doing hard work?
I don't... I know which of those tasks I would rather do. And there's a kind of an obvious answer to your question, but I would say that you're both working pretty hard.
Well, that's the second question. Again, it's kind of mid-afternoon. It's 90 degrees out. I'm sitting in my office, air-conditioned office, drinking a cup of coffee, reading a book about Congress, and my wife is out weeding the garden. Who's doing hard work?
Again, I know which of those things I would rather do. I know which work is harder.
Okay.
I mean, the reading, I don't know what book you were reading.
Oh, a book about Congress.
How intensive it is. I guess I would say your wife is working harder than you. But, like, you know, I'm working on a manuscript on a book on theology and politics. And, like, nothing is harder than writing that book. I mean, nothing requires such energy and focus. I would much rather do physical. I mean, I would say for me, physical labor is easier than that.
But, and then one final question. If I'm teaching a class while my wife is reading a report from the city administrator in her capacity as an alderman, which of us is doing hard work?
Again, I think you're both working pretty hard. But
no, the right answer to each of these is whatever I'm doing is the thing that counts as hard work.
Okay,
for future reference here.
But yes, if listeners haven't figured it out, our topic today is hard work. And, you know, I can't remember, Coyle, how we even where this idea came from, or whether it was yours or mine. I think we're actually recording an episode, and then either you or I said, oh, we should do an episode on hard work. I don't know if that seems like an obviously political topic to people. I mean, our podcast is politics pretty broadly construed.
Right.
But I do think that it is a kind of political topic and has political valence. Like, the idea of hard work, I think, forms a part of, like, the American imagination and the way that we see ourselves and certainly our national destiny. But it just seemed like a super interesting topic to talk about. You know, you wanted to start off talking about these three famous rules. I actually am unfamiliar with these three famous rules.
Yeah, so these are actually out of a Brookings study that was done a few years back. I don't remember the name of the scholars who released the report. But if people are familiar with them today, it is likely because they're listening to conservative talking heads or have read Ben Sasse's new book. So I mentioned these in class once upon a time, and one of my students was like, "Oh, you've been listening to Ben Shapiro," and I was like, "No. This is actually from a left wing think tank." But the three rules for staying out of poverty: graduate from high school, don't have children until after you're married, tied to that, don't get married until after you're 21, and get a full time job. It doesn't matter what the full time job is; just get a full time job. Since the study came out, stay off drugs, stay off addictive substances. So, including things like tobacco and alcohol, has also been added to the list. And I think those things are true and fine and all of that. One of the points of the study is that those are all true without regard to class or race. So you can be poor and a minority. Gender is irrelevant. Like, if you follow those three characteristics, you will succeed. You will make it in American life.
Yeah, the statistics of the number of people who do all three of those things and stay out of poverty. I mean, do you know what it is off the top of your head?
I don't know off the top of my head. My point was just the addition to those three things is hard work. If you do all of those things but don't work hard, you're not going to climb out of poverty or stay in the middle class or whatever the particular goal is, whatever your definition of, you know, air quotes, making it in American life is. So hard work is, I think, essential, but it's maybe essential but not sufficient, which raises all sorts of questions like what is it and is it a virtue and why does it matter and so on, which is why we want to do it as an episode.
Yeah, so what would you say hard work is, Mr. Quill Neal?
That's a tough question. It's one of those things that you recognize when you see it, right? I think hard work has to do with some combination of time and effort. And I think once we try to get more specific than that, it gets to be really difficult. I think as you were saying earlier, when we talk about it kind of in the culture, we usually mean manual labor. Right. There's a point to it. There's a focus on it, and it involves some kind of physical effort, but physical effort in a way that, say, you're running marathons wouldn't include, even though that's certainly more difficult. A marathon is going to be more physically taxing than most manual labor jobs out there, just because it's something that the human body isn't really designed to do.
I actually think it is designed to do, but that's a whole other topic. We'll do a running episode.
We can do a running. You and Jay Eldred should do.
Yeah, that's right. He runs marathons too.
Crazy people.
I will say, yeah, I understand what you mean. I mean, just because marathon running isn't, it's not work. It's leisure, which is something that we'll talk about.
It is without telos.
That's definitely not true.
You're not being chased by anyone with a gun, and you're not trying to get somewhere first, and you're not creating something. And again, this is tying it into the physical component of it, right? You're not digging a ditch, and you're not planting a garden, and you're not building something on an assembly line. All of the things you would think of.
I'm objecting to the point in which you said it doesn't have a telos, it doesn't have an end or goal. I mean, and it's particularly apt that you use that word just because we associate marathons with Greek culture, and like you think about the Greek culture of the gymnasium and physical development. I mean, the point of it is, this is beside the point. I mean, the point of it is like the development of physical excellences.
Yeah, sorry, I should have said without a the kind of telos again that we would associate with manual labor.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe the telos is physical health, right? But even that, running a marathon is not necessary for that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say the goal is physical health. I would say, like, the goal is the achievement of the... It's not health, it's performance. It's like perfecting the body so that it can perform this really hard task.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, so when we say hard work, we mean work, and so we're distinguishing that from leisure. We do typically sort of associate it or particularly valorize physical labor, which is something that I want to come back to in a little bit. So I guess the point is that it's like it's practical in a particular kind of a way. It's sort of like the things that we have to do in order to survive, either whether that is planting food or earning a paycheck.
Well, and it's not just doing those, because you can do those things and not be working hard. Right, you could plant a garden and then never take care of it, you can have a job and not work very hard at it. Obviously, lots of people do that. So I would say hard work is not just set apart from leisure; it's also set apart from laziness. Right? It's set apart
from sloth. But so the work aspect specifies the kind of activity that you're doing,
right,
which would distinguish it from, say, marathon running in the first instance. But then we're talking about, so we think of it as being a virtue, right? So it's a disposition to be willing to endure practical efforts that are demanding, let's say, you know?
Right. To work hard, I hate to use the term, to rigorously engage in things that maybe aren't demanding but have to be done.
Yeah, sure.
So you can work hard, again, you can work hard in retail, which is not the most, I got to be careful how I say this, because I have done retail, so I know there are ways in which it is taxing, but it is not difficult skilled labor, I guess, maybe that's the way to say that, but you can work hard at it anyway.
Yeah, sure, and if, like, you don't like that kind of a work, Like, I mean, I can't imagine a harder, like, to me, like, I can't imagine a harder job than that.
Food service, maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, but, yeah, just because my introverted disposition is just, like, finds random social encounters with strangers to be.
Sure.
Like, that's taxing. Whereas, like, you know, marathon running is hard, but it's, there's a perverse kind of pleasure in it. And I'd certainly rather mow the yard than, but you know, but we both described it as a virtue. And so maybe it's worthwhile to sort of say a little bit about, like, what a virtue is. And I guess we've talked about such things, but, like, the idea of a virtue is most classically developed in the Western intellectual tradition by Aristotle. And for Aristotle, virtues were inculcated habits of mind. They are attempts to take aspects of human psychology and work on them and develop them so that they manifest themselves in particular kinds of ways. And for Aristotle, there were intellectual virtues being excellences of thought, and then there were emotional virtues, which are virtues that we sort of more classically think of, like courage, which are excellences over particular emotional domains. So part of what it is to be courageous is to have so trained your psyche that you are not overcome or overwhelmed or controlled by fear. Aristotle thought that there were something like 12 virtues, depending on how you count. Courage is a virtue. Temperance or self-control is a virtue. Good temper, which is the virtue regarding anger, is a virtue. Honesty is a virtue. Interestingly, for Aristotle, there isn't, we come back to this in a second, there isn't anything that just sort of looks like a virtue of hard work. Maybe temperance is in there. Self-control counts.
I mean, in Aristotle and Plato, it is, it's as with our three characteristics from the Brookings Sling, it's not discussed explicitly, but I think it's pretty clearly assumed, right? I mean, Aristotle is assuming that you are going to work hard at being courageous, especially if you are not courageous to begin with.
Yeah, and I think that falls under, I mean, it probably generally falls under the category of temperance, right? So temperance is self-control, the sort of the willingness to put aside the thing that you really want to do in favor of the thing that you really need to do.
Right.
And temperance, you know, is a particularly important virtue just because, you know, absent temperance, I mean, no virtue is really possible and really no kind of activity. Like, there is no development of any human capacity that doesn't involve effort and focus. So that's certainly right. I mean, that general trait is a central trait, and it's probably explicitly identified by Aristotle sort of under the category of hard work. What's interesting to me, though, is that, like, there doesn't exist something like that distinctly modern virtue. He doesn't isolate it in that particular way by picking out as hard work.
Right.
Which maybe we'll get to in a second. But a little bit generally, the reason why all of those virtues matter is because they are the traits that you need to have in order to flourish, given the kind of creature that you are, which is kind of why the virtues matter for Aristotle. Like, given the kind of creature that we are, you need to be courageous in order to live a good life. You need to be temperate in order to live a good life. So they're the qualities that you have to have in order to flourish. And then one interesting thing that comes out of the work of the modern virtue theorist Alistair MacIntyre in his really famous book, After Virtue, is that MacIntyre brings up this interesting connection between the virtues and social practices. And so part of what constitutes the good for us is embedded in certain kinds of social practices. MacIntyre is developing a particular kind of modern account of the virtues that is a little bit skeptical, at least when he's writing this particular book, but that's skeptical about the idea of there just being, like, some fundamental good for human beings. And so he roots his account in social practices. So the goods that human beings care about arise out of social practices. And so in that way, the virtues are kind of specific to social ways of life, which I think is a really interesting idea that, again, I kind of want to come back to when we talk about hard work as a distinctively modern virtue. But there's a way in which the virtues for any given culture are a little bit specific to their given social practices and their ways of life.
And that's certainly not something Aristotle would disagree with, right? I mean,
Yeah. I mean, the difference is that underlying Aristotle's metaphysic is that he just thinks things have functions, like essential functions, and that's something that McIntyre, at least in 1980, when he's writing After Virtue, is totally skeptical about.
Right.
But it does bring out this really interesting idea in the way in which certain kinds of social qualities are specific to cultures. So, what's an example? In Asian cultures, say, humility is a particularly important virtue. I mean, would you say that humility is like an American virtue? It kind of is, and it kind of isn't.
Oh, no. I mean, maybe once upon a time, I don't think so. I suppose you could, if you want to go way back into the colonial era when the Puritans still held some kind of dominance, but no.
I mean, I think something like that streak still exists, so that, like, people will praise humility, but even those, like, efforts to praise humility are kind of done in, like, this
very public format.
I'm just trying to say humble. So,
The humble brag, but, right?
Yeah. So, humility is a virtue. For listeners at home, I'm putting my fingers up. But it's not really a virtue in contemporary American culture in the way that, like, it's a really, really important virtues in other cultures, say, in certain kinds of Asian cultures. Like, a really, really important virtue. It's a necessary trait given social expectations and forms of the good in other kinds of cultures. So that's a way in which, like, virtues are a little bit social specific.
Now, is there, and maybe neither of us maybe is really the person to ask this, are there cultures where hard work in its proper context is not a virtue? I mean, I know there are cultures that value leisure more or differently than ours does. Right?
Mm-hmm.
There are cultures where nap time is just part of your day.
Mm-hmm.
But even those cultures, I don't know that I would say that they don't believe in hard work.
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly they do. But there's a way in which, I don't know that they hallow it in the way that we do in 20th century America. Like, it's not just a virtue. It's like it's a particularly hallowed virtue.
Right.
In the contemporary United States, like, there's almost nothing worse than being called lazy.
Right. We have politicians run for office promising to put Americans back to work.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, everybody thinks hard work is a good thing. But, like, what's interesting about the virtue of hard work, I think, for us, is that, like, it is a cardinal virtue. Maybe in some ways, like, it is, like, the highest virtue for us. Like, there's nothing worse than being called lazy.
Right. Well, and I think in part that's because of the tangible results of it. And this is something that both in the J.D. Vance book that we did the episode on a ways back, and in Ben Sasse's new book on social interactions. In both of them, they talk about the distinction between the lazy poor and the hardworking poor, and how one group of them is historically despised and the other group of them is sort of historically lionized and becomes kind of the target for people running for office.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I think one of the reasons that hard work gets so enshrined is because of the hardworking poor. In general, if you are hardworking, you tend not to stay poor, which isn't to say you instantly become rich, but over time, if you continue working hard and meet those other criteria that we mentioned at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
you tend to move from being poor into being the middle class, and that's something people want to do. That's again, the American dream, right, is that middle class lifestyle. So the virtue that gets you there is, of course, going to be hallowed and enshrined.
Yeah. I mean, that gets precisely at the way in which I think the virtue is political in that way. And in a lot of ways kind of gets at, I think, really fundamental differences about the way in which we see the, like, the role of government in social welfare programs. But, I mean, part of what's interesting to me about that rhetoric of hard work, it's sort of like, well, what do you do if... So, this is why I think talking about hard work as a virtue is really beneficial. So it's a trait that you need to develop, as all the traits are. You know, the interesting thing about Aristotle is he thinks none of the virtues are natural. They're second nature, as it were. Like, you have the capacity to acquire them, but nobody has them naturally. You have to get them, ironically, through hard work, right? You have to inculcate and develop and train yourself so that you become courageous, just, temperate, honest, etc. But, you know, the problem is that, like, there's a difference between just being poor and being the kind of person whose poverty makes you vulnerable to certain kinds of trauma of various different kinds. And so if you grow up in a household with a lot of neglect or with a lot of abuse, then, like, we just know now that deprivations or traumas, especially before the age of two, really, really lead to disrupted neurological development. I mean, the research on this stuff is really, really interesting. But I think part of one reason why I don't like that distinction between, like, the hardworking poor and, like, the lazy poor. Yeah, like, there are people who are just lazy. But, like, why are they lazy? I think the issue is that, like, in some kinds of contexts, people are just exposed to so much trauma and deprivation that they it cripples their normal human development. Like, there's a reason why people are lazy, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that can be true, but that also doesn't negate personal responsibility, right?
The idea of personal responsibility is related to that. But, like, what if I'm an infant and I grow up and I'm exposed to deprivation? So all the literature on, like, infant cognitive development is so interesting. And, like, those first 2 years of human development are so crucial to the development of, like, of the human brain. And that includes everything from cognitive function to emotional regulation. So, and there's a little bit of, like, this 2-year window where, like, if those deprivations aren't addressed early on, it's really, really hard, not exactly impossible, but really, really hard to make up the difference outside of that. And so a lot of public policy people are spending a lot more time sort of thinking about those first 2 years. And it really is, it's deprivation. Like, normal human cognitive development requires constant social stimulation. Absent that kind of social stimulation, the human brain won't develop normally. Traumas play a particularly devastating role in emotional regulation and development and attachment and all of that stuff, right? And so, like, if you're exposed to trauma, if you experience deprivation before the age of two, before the age at which you can really be responsible, and now your basic machinery for... Well, I mean, for everything, right? For the acquisition of the virtue of hard work or responsibility, intellectual skills, emotional regulation. If all of that stuff is disrupted, then it becomes really difficult to sort of talk about personal responsibility in that way. Have we talked about this?
I don't think so.
This is stuff that I'm reading and thinking a lot about these days. I'll throw a couple articles up in the show notes. You're kind of giving me that little bit of that skeptical hand.
Well, this
on
is
chin.
The I didn't know we were going to talk about this, so
yeah,
I wasn't
yeah,
prepared
yeah, yeah,
to
yeah,
and don't
yeah.
have a response.
It just
look.
Kind of came up. Anyways, yeah. I'll throw some show notes up. We should talk about that. That's something that I'm really, really interested in these
yeah.
days.
And I have not read what you've been reading. But again, while admitting yes, upbringing affects you. Certainly that matters. There also comes a point where it doesn't, right? I can say that, hey, if that child is misbehaving, that is the fault of the parents, and the parents are morally responsible in that case. Now, maybe the child has some responsibility.
Sure.
But there's also a tipping point, and we could argue about when it is, right? Is it when you become a teenager, when you become adult, or whatever those things even mean? There comes a point when that responsibility is no longer on your background. It's now on you. Taking into account, you know, all reasonable disclaimers for people with, you know, genuine disabilities and so on.
I guess the point that I'm getting at is that there isn't really a hard distinction between people with quote-unquote genuine disabilities and people who experience really crushing traumas or deprivation when they're young.
Well, and again,
that,
I don't...
Like, that is a disability, as it were. Because it literally changes the way in which the brain gets wired.
Yeah, so I don't know the science or the proper terms, but it would seem that there is a distinction between someone who has the capacity to, say, have a full-time job and support themselves, mm-hmm. and someone who does not and never will.
Right? Yeah,
I feel like that's a pretty solid line.
I would say that distinction isn't nearly as solid as you think it is.
And yeah, obviously there are going to be individual cases where it's fuzzy and I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure you guys have some version of this too. We get the notes at the beginning of every semester from our disability office saying, hey, you're going to have such and such students, mm-hmm. and this is what you need to do. Obviously there are always going to be kind of borderline cases where maybe those students ought not be in college at all, and maybe they should be, and they're with the extra help they're going to be able to make it. And I'm certainly not competent to be able to tell what's what.
Yeah.
But there are also times when the answer is pretty clearly no.
This person is not going to be able to do it. That's certainly the case.
There are a handful of borderline cases, but in general, no. This individual has the capacity, or at least has the potential for the capacity, and at some point the responsibility, even for failing to develop the potential, falls on the individual rather than on the family in the background.
Well, yeah, this is a tangent.
Right. Potential hard work.
We should talk about that. I mean, I think to sort of pull us back into the topic of the day.
Sure.
I think one thing that's interesting about that little discussion is sort of the way in which, it's building out this idea of hard work. So it's like part of the ideas of hard work is tied to this idea of responsibility. Taking care of oneself, providing for one's family, like that's a little bit of the mix of part
within
of
your capacity, right? Within what you.
Oh, sure, 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 sure. Yeah, sure. But like, given that, I think that's part of the modern construction of the idea of hard work. One of the things that interests me, we were talking about this a little bit, is that like, there's something like the virtue of hard work embedded in Aristotle's understanding of temperance. But he certainly doesn't identify in a kind of unique way the way in which something like the modern virtue of hard work. Like something like those traits are obviously valuable and are identified under the virtue of temperance. And then I think the ideal of hard work is a distinctively modern virtue as opposed to an ancient one. And I don't think, and this is just kind of me thinking for 15 minutes about intellectual history, but I don't think you really find anybody in the ancient or medieval Western worlds sort of identifying something like the virtue of hard work, really isolating it and hallowing it in the particularly distinctive modern way until you get to Franklin and Franklin's famous, how many virtues are there? You teach
13 or 15. So I forget now. It's been a while. We don't need to get bogged down in the history. I think you can make the case that I don't know as much about the medievals. So if the medievals thought that the antidote to sloth was hard work,
So sloth is a vice.
Yeah. So it's one of the seven deadly sins, right? Is sloth. And it may be that hard work was an antidote. I'm not familiar enough with them, but certainly. After the Reformation and in the Reformed tradition, I'm not familiar enough with the Lutheran or Anabaptist traditions to know what they say, but you do have the development of hard work as a virtue.
Mm. The whole Protestant work ethic business.
Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't have called it that, and they would always be very careful to say it is a virtue in sort of the civil sense, right? It's like voting. You know, it's informed voting is something you should do, but it's not going to save you, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to be very careful not to go into a works righteousness kind of mode, and maybe that's why we tend not to think about it, because they spend so much time arguing against justification by works that we automatically assume that there's no there's nothing favorable to say at all about work. But yeah, they're very, very big on spend your time well and do a lot of hard work for basically all of the same reasons we would say, to feed your family, to
Yeah. And so, and then I think the reason why it's a particularly hallowed ideal, so we get that sort of through the Puritans, I guess.
And then
right?
Franklin secularizes that, right?
Yeah, takes it
out of its religious context and says this is still a virtue.
Industriousness is what he calls it.
Right.
But it's interesting to me that, like, and so in, I mean, I'm sure this isn't strictly speaking true, but you know, he certainly gives prominence. He's a prominent figure. He gives prominence. And now it sort of identifies in a very direct, specific way industriousness as his virtue in that famous list of 13 virtues that he was trying to inculcate in himself or whatever, right?
Right.
But like, in a lot of ways, it's like this distinctively modern virtue insofar as, like, hard, it's not just, like, hard work, but it's sort of tied to kind of, like, this individualism, this taking care of oneself, this taking responsibility for forging one's own destiny, the taking care of one's family. And so it has like these, that ingredient of like individualism, like heroic, I'm going to take care of myself individualism. That's like kind of like this distinctively modern feature.
And how much of that do you think is just tied to the collapse of any kind of modern view of leisure as a virtue?
Yeah, so this is in our notes. You put this on the list, and I was like, oh, yeah, of course we should talk about leisure. I mean, so what did you say, that there isn't a modern virtue of leisure?
Yeah, I don't – I mean, obviously, moderns have leisure and have more leisure than, you know, any people in the history of the world, whether you're rich or middle class or poor. It doesn't matter. I mean, we all have leisure of some kind. I don't know how often I hear people talking about it as a virtue, or as a, I'm trying to think what's Aristotle's term for this, right? Leisure is a further opportunity to better yourself. And it's not something where you turn everything off, veg out in front of a screen. It's an opportunity. Basically,
come on, everybody knows that Aristotle would binge watch, you know, Game of Thrones. He talks about that in the politics, I think.
He would certainly write fan fiction for it too.
Yeah, you know, so there's a way in which something like leisure is built into the virtue of temperance, just because for Aristotle the virtues are mean or average, or like balanced states between two kinds of extremes. So right. Temperance is the virtue regarding I mean, I guess discipline. Like a lack of temperance is the pretty obvious vice. I guess that's sloth or something like that. But then equally, he thinks like you can have too much temperance, as it were. And so if you never enjoy things, I think he calls that vice insensitivity. And that is a vice that is you rarely confront in the modern world. But like you can imagine, if you don't know anybody who's too abstemious, you can imagine somebody who's just like too abstemious, and that's a vice for Aristotle.
Right, and the goal of the virtues for Aristotle is the vision of the good, right? This interaction that you have with transcendence, and leisure is your opportunity to really meditate on that, right? To kind of leisurely think about and reflect on commune with, although he wouldn't have necessarily used that term, this highest ideal, the highest, the ultimate good. And again, I think we don't have that kind of category, right? We don't have that language. We don't have that idea of, hey, I am now done working, so I'm going to start thinking about virtue and beauty and truth and goodness.
I mean, I do that every day, Cole.
Yeah, but it's part of your work, Ed.
Yeah. So it's like the American attitude towards leisure is funny because on the one hand we are guilty about it and like we kind of celebrate it and don't celebrate it. Like you're right. There's no time in history in which people have engaged in so much leisure, and this is just made possible by modernity, right? I mean, there are books on the 4-hour work week, right? That kind of how I'm going to get all my work done in 4 hours. That's kind of an interesting idea in some ways because it's sort of valorizing super hard work. Like, I'm going to work really hard and really efficiently and really smartly for 4 hours, and then I'm going to be at leisure. Somebody who, like, we certainly frown upon, we valorize and frown upon, like, decadent leisure. I mean, we celebrate it in our, you know, in our Instagram likes as we like the photo of, you know, Kim Kardashian lounging on a yacht in the Bahamas. You follow her, right?
If I were on Instagram, I suppose I would. Do you have a choice? Like, if you're on Instagram, don't you have
to? You
do.
Yeah, you do. You do. You do have a choice. But then equally, like, I don't know. This virtue is so class-specific in some ways. Like, we criticize people who don't work hard.
I mean,
we were talking about this a little bit. It's so class-specific. And so there's a particular kind of, like, achievement, you know, upper-class achievement class that...
I mean, it is. So I'm not on Instagram, but assuming that what I see on Facebook is similar, the elites are in the Mediterranean doing their cruises or whatever. I mean, the friends and family I have who are poor, I basically see doing the same thing, just on a different scale, right? Mm-hmm. They're instead of cruising the Mediterranean, they might be out fishing on the local river, mm-hmm. or honestly, just watching TV at home. Or I mean, there are any number of things that I see that if they had more money, maybe they would be doing the elite thing, but they don't have it. So they're doing mm-hmm. functionally the same thing, mm-hmm. just on in a different location or on a different scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that either of them are necessarily more or less virtuous based mm-hmm. on that activity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, my wider point was just that there's this way in which we're schizophrenic about leisure. Like on the one hand, we love it. On the other hand, it's like we don't want to admit that we do it. Well, but here's a picture of me at, you know, on my boat in Cabo drinking a margarita. But yeah, it's just we're very schizophrenic on leisure and hard work.
Right. Which and I mean I get that. So I certainly have the things that I do for leisure, and they're not necessarily the best use of my time. You know, the Puritans would be horrified how much time I spend reading a novel, right? Especially in the summers, right? Because that's all we academics do is watch TV and read novels.
I don't read novels.
I know your life is sad in that particular way, Ed.
That's a character flaw. I am reading Brené Brown's Dare to Lead, which is a really good book, I should say. But anyways,
is that a novel?
No, it's like a. What is it? I mean, it's nonfiction. Well, you know who Brené Brown is, don't you? Like her
I do not.
She is a she has a super viral TED Talk. Like, to be honest, I actually haven't seen the TED Talk, but I'm reading her book. But I think you and I apparently are the only people who haven't seen the TED Talk. But it's about her PhD is in like social work or something like that. But she kind of has become a big business and organizational and leadership consultant, but like her jam is vulnerability basically, and how important vulnerability is in leadership and just in human life and stuff like that.
Okay. That sounds like a lot of things that I would disagree with, but
yeah, and you would be wrong and maybe you're going to hell for thinking that, but
fair enough. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever seen any TED Talk. So maybe I'm using my leisure okay, right? Maybe I'm a little bit ahead of the game there.
But you sit around and you read novels.
Yeah, you know, I do occasionally watch TV. That's not fair. I the wife and I watch some TV, not every day, but pretty close to it.
Mm-hmm.
But also not a whole lot either. So, and we do it communally, I guess.
I think that's really important. Oh, I think the communal watching of TV, and you, like, your kids probably aren't old enough yet to really like where you all watch TV together.
Oh, no, no, no. Our kids don't watch a whole lot of TV at all. This is after they go to bed. Like, we'll watch something.
So we do that. But then, like, when you watch, when your kids get older and you can watch stuff as a unit and, like, talk about it, like, that's pretty awesome, actually.
Yeah, and I think there are ways in which that's okay leisure. But I think there are also ways we could certainly be doing things better. So.
Oh, sure. But, you know.
Like you said, schizophrenic, right?
Yeah, exactly. Protestant work ethic. We valorize it. We also hate it.
Right.
Coyle, you had here a note about wanting to talk about Solzhenitsyn. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, not extensively, but this is not Solzhenitsyn exactly, but in Auschwitz, the sign over the entrance to the concentration camp said in German, of course, "Work makes freedom," right? Which is interesting that for any number of reasons, and I think particularly cruel that that sign was put there, because in some ways that is one of the promises of Western civilization, right? Just work hard. And that will help you to achieve kind of the best life you can over a place where that was absolutely never going to happen, right? So there was a lie, taking something that was true and using it to make the camp that much worse for the people who were going into it.
Famously, the B on the sign, Arbeit macht frei, is the German, and the B in Arbeit is upside down. I think nobody knows, like, who made the sign or why, but there's, like, a kind of an interpretation of that, that, like, whatever prisoner was making the sign as a kind of sign of silent protest put the B on.
Yeah, and I think it's, right, despite themselves, I think the Germans gave us something that is true, because at the end of the day, certainly as Christians, at the end of the day, work will not make you free, right? I mean, work as hard as you want. Hard work will not save us. So it is ultimately going to be futile. The other side of that, and this is where Solzhenitsyn comes in, his novel, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, one of the things that makes the day such a good day for Ivan is when he gets to do hard work that is actually meaningful. Mm-hmm. So this guy who's living in the gulag, I forget, I think he's building a wall in a building that they're constructing. I don't remember if he was a mason in real life or if he just happened to have the skill set. But part of the reason it was a good day for him is because he was doing something meaningful with his hands that wasn't just drudgery and toil. So it's the other side of it. There is some freedom in hard work, right? Even when you're in the gulag, doing something that is rigorous but positively constructive can bring some kind of meaning in this life. So, I mean, there's that bipolarity again, right? That schizophrenia that you were talking about earlier, where both things are true. It's not going to bring us salvation. It is still a part of human existence, right? It's still a part of who we are, and it's a necessary part, I think, which we should leave the theology of hard work to the end. But I think it's interesting that we have those two parallels, both in very similar circumstances, sort of side by side, teaching opposite messages.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So I maybe one of the reasons why we're kind of schizophrenic about hard work in the modern world and why it's a distinctively modern virtue is that, like, I mean, there's a way in which nobody in the pre-modern world needed to tell you to work hard, because literally, if you didn't work hard, you wouldn't eat and you would die.
Right.
But now with modernity, with industrialization and technology and progress, now, like, work of that sort becomes optional for us. And so, but we still need to work. So it, precisely because it's optional, the virtue becomes hallowed in a particular kind of a way. I mean, I also think it becomes hallowed for other complicated cultural reasons that we were talking about earlier. But then, because work in the modern world is still necessary, but not as necessary as it used to be. And it's now mediated through, so we're no longer working in the fields, we're working in the factory, or we're doing information work. Now our toil isn't the physical drudgery of working crops, but like fears of, carpal tunnel, you know, which is genuinely painful. So now you get the conflict between like modern industrialized soulless work over and against like the purity and honesty and naturalness of like working with your hands, working in nature. And so, yeah. And so like, again, this modern ideal of hard work is very much kind of formed by like this modern industrialized technological context that we find ourselves.
Right. We all agree a little bit deep down with Wendell Berry, right? There's something more virtuous about living on a farm and being closer to the land and what have you than working in a factory or working in an office or.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that, actually.
No, I'm not saying he's right. I'm saying I think we all, as Americans, we all kind of instinctively say, yeah, there's something to that. Whether we should or not, it's a different question. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. But yeah, so and then all of these discussions about hard work are just bound up in our worries about modernity. I mean, like, modernity is awesome, but and the point about Solzhenitsyn was particularly interesting just because, like, in that Russian intellectual tradition, you certainly get like in it made me think of Tolstoy, right? And in what is it, Anna Karenina, I guess. Levin, that's the protagonist of Anna Karenina. Hey, look at this! I'm talking about novels, Quill and Neil.
Huh.
Yeah, you get there's a kind of celebration of honest agrarian physical hard work, and there's this criticism of like. Elite modern culture. That's still pre-industrial, but certainly you get like that celebration of honest hard. That celebration of like the peasant in Tolstoy and
right, or same thing in Tolkien, right? I mean, it's the good guys are the ones who live kind of simple, hardworking lives.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And properly hardworking, right, with a proper dose of leisure, rightly understood. And the bad guys are the ones who come along and build factories and
cut down trees and Though the Hobbit thing, I mean, we never see Bilbo or Frodo working. I mean,
they're wealthy.
Yeah, they're wealthy. And the Hobbits, man, they're like always eating and drinking. I mean, are they ever? It's certainly like the general picture is of like simple, honest English countryside life. It's like the Cotswolds, basically,
right,
for people who've been to the Cotswolds. But are there any scenes of like hobbits working, like plowing fields?
Oh yeah, Sam Gamgee, right? He's the working class.
Oh yeah, he's the working class.
The gardener and his gaffer, right? I forget if that's his uncle or grandfather or whatever, but.
Uh-huh.
I've just angered all of the Tolkien listeners out there by not knowing that bit of arcane trivia. But, they're the working class folks and do the hard work. But they also, again, properly exercise leisure. So we see them drinking at the pub and we see them at the parties and we see them both working and recreating appropriately.
Yeah. And then they have breakfast and then they have elevenses and then they have lunch. And then what happens in the afternoon? I guess they have tea.
Tea,
and then they have supper. Anything happen between lunch and tea?
Nap time, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, yeah. You want to? Maybe we should wrap up with some theological considerations on the virtue of work.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't have anything earth-shaking to say here. Work predates the fall, right?
That's really important. And I think a lot of people, something that a lot of people don't appreciate.
Right, and again, this may also help explain our schizophrenia. It predates the fall. It's part of the image of God. It is a natural inclination that we should have. It is also specifically cursed in the fall.
Yeah. So, Yeah, so it gets harder.
Well, not just harder, it gets futile, right? It is not going to go away, but it is also not going to do what we want it to do.
Sure. Well, yeah, and so bears the brokenness of the fall. I mean, yeah. I don't know if that means that it becomes futile or pointless. But it just becomes broken in the way that everything is broken. Like, broken in the way that relationships are broken.
Yeah, I'll stick with it's futile in that it will not satisfy, right? It will not succeed in restoring us to what we were supposed to have been doing in the first place, right? That's where we need that external savior to come along
I guess I would want to make a point of like distinguishing between work and works, as it were, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, we haven't really done a whole lot with that, I suppose, have we?
Yeah. You said something earlier that made me want to sort of distinguish a little between work and works. I mean, they're obviously related, but like works is attempts to earn our own salvation, and like that's a little bit different than. I mean, we can work hard at that, and we can be obsessed by that, but that's a little bit different than like plowing the back nine.
Right. Although it is plowing the back nine that is cursed, right, in Genesis 3.
And now why? Because the ground is hard and rocky and there are lots of weeds.
Right.
But Adam and Eve plowed the back nine. It was just that it was easy.
Well, easier. Easy, and it was in line with what they were supposed to accomplish. And I don't know that you can make the case that after the fall it was.
Yeah.
I mean, in that it got them food, it did, but that is not sufficient, right? Again, it preserved physical life. It did not restore fellowship. They were no longer.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. But like, yeah, but nobody thinks that, right? I mean, nobody thinks that. Well, I mean, I say nobody. You know what I mean? Almost nobody thinks that, like, I'm gonna save the world by.
No, but again, this goes back to that promise of if only you work hard, then you will be successful and happy, right? Mm-hmm. And this does tie into both Aristotle and kind of the American dream. What do you really need? Well, work hard and you will accomplish it. And because of the fall, that's just never going to be true. Yeah. Right? You will never be satisfied. Work as hard as you want, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It will never satisfy.
Sure. I've actually been writing about this. I have a chapter in my book sort of unpacking a kind of a creational theology. But I really do think that a lot of people kind of think that, oh, in the Garden of Eden, before the fall, Adam and Eve were just like hanging out and lounging. And then now we have to work because of the fall, which is not the biblical picture. And so like I often make this point in class when I'm teaching. We often think of the Garden of Eden as being like this bucolic place with no intentional cultivation, like no buildings, no fields, no.
It's a Rousseau's Island.
Right? Yeah, exactly. A natural tropical paradise. But like it definitely isn't that. Like the Hebrew word that is translated as garden is gan. And like a gan is like it's a garden. It's like it is always a walled, developed space. And so I always tell my students, like, when you picture the Garden of Eden, you should picture not, like, some desert tropical island, but, like, the gardens at Versailles or something like that. And what's important about that, I think, is that, like, both of those pictures of the physical environs of Eden come with them, like, theological anthropologies, like, views about human nature. And so if you think of it as a tropical island, you just picture Adam and Eve just kind of hanging out and just lying in the sun and splashing in the waves and reaching up into the trees and picking fruit. But like when you think of it properly as a garden, they're gardeners. Like they are tending. God tells them to abad in Shamar, to nurture and protect the garden. They're like working in the garden. They're developing. Just as God creates, they're creating stuff that honors God, that supports their lives together. They're perfect harmony with each other and God, and they're creating just as God creates. And so, like, work is supposed to be awesome. God is a creator. Like, the God who we meet in Genesis 1, his most fundamental act is that of creator. And we're made in his image. Like, it, but the problem is, work isn't the problem. The problem is the fall. And now work gets hard and is poisoned. And but, like, we're made to work. Work is awesome. The satisfaction that we feel after a good hard day's work, that's awesome. That's kind of how I interpret God's day of rest. Like, God didn't really need to rest. It wasn't like, whew, I'm pooped. It was more like, I think it symbolically points out the need for us to rest and to worship.
Sure.
But more than that, like, God's satisfaction with, like, his extraordinary creation.
Sure. I don't disagree with that.
Awesome sauce. And so
we work hard, Ed?
We should work really hard, and we should play harder. No, I actually don't mean that. Work, play, worship. That's what we were meant to do.
There you go.
So what do you have on tap for the rest of the day? I'm actually going to go work and try to get some writing done. I have a chapter to edit.
I'm going to read and write a book review that I have that I've been sitting on for a while, and keep getting ready for this reading group that's coming up.
Awesome. I might try to also play some tennis with my son. And I got to get out and see this new Spider-Man movie.
That's on my list. I don't know if I could see it in theaters or not. But
have we talked about the Avengers movies?
We've chatted about them briefly and some episode in the past.
I want to do like an Avengers podcast, but that's really just an excuse to talk about them. Like, I can't think of any particular political relevance, but I'll...
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to do that. Sectarian Review's done several of them
maybe
already.
Maybe we can do something with Danny.
But yeah, that'd be fine. I think I've seen all of them, so...
All of the Avengers movies?
I think I've seen everything from the original, from the first Iron Man through Endgame.
Okay, so all the MCU movies.
Yeah.
I think I haven't seen, like, the second Thor movie.
Okay. They're all good. I mean, I think the biggest stinker in the bunch, and I say stinker, including it as a good movie, is Age of Ultron. I think it's the weakest of them.
Yeah, you know, I understand why you would say that. I like that movie in a strange kind of way. Like,
it was fine. Like, it was a fine movie, but just compared to the others.
Best Avengers. This has nothing to do with anything. Best Avengers.
Best Avengers movie. Oh, that's. It's been so long since I've seen some of those early ones.
That you should have, you should, there's a correct answer to this question. It should be right.
I don't know. What's the correct answer?
The correct answer is Civil War.
Civil War was good. I think I liked the first Captain America better than the Civil War, but I think it was just a fun movie.
I haven't seen that in a while.
I will say, I think Iron Man has to be given credit, and we are so off hard work now. Iron Man has to
be... Well, now we're talking about leisure.
Yeah, there we go. Iron Man has to be given credit, because if you had told me in 2007 that I would like Marvel movies better than DC movies for the next decade, I would have laughed in your face.
Oh, so you're more a DC kind of
guy. I'm a DC guy. Other than the DC movies have been terrible. So, I think what Iron Man did in taking the obscure Marvel character and turning it into a high-quality franchise that... basically doesn't have any weak points. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
I was never really a DC person. I will say that the Christopher... I like all of the Batman movies, and the three Christopher Nolan Batmans are unbelievable.
Like, you like the George Clooney Batman movie?
I do. Yeah, with the
nipple suit. Your judgment on movies has to be suspect then.
George Clooney doesn't like Batman. But the Christopher Nolan, I mean, like, I think those three Christopher Nolan Batmans, those might be the greatest superhero movies ever made, actually.
I think the first two were good, especially The Dark Knight. The third one was just a hot mess.
I can't even remember which one that is.
Dark Knight Rises. But The Dark Knight did such a... What's that? Yeah, Bane.
Bane? I like that one a lot.
It just... The Dark Knight did such a number on everything that came after. Everything after, because it was a darker movie... DC tries to get darker and darker and darker, thinking that's what people want to watch. And you can maybe kind of do that with Batman, but you can't do that with Superman. And you shouldn't do that. So
I think kind of the genius of the Marvel movies is actually them figuring out how to make them funny and to integrate humor in a pretty deep way. And right. and once they figured that out, and I think they figured that out in Thor Ragnarok, which is sure. also a really, really good one. But I think that's the first one that's like, I mean, that's almost, the Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I guess.
Oh yeah, those were good too.
But like Thor, especially, that third Thor after the second Thor, which is pretty serious, right? But like, yeah. it's really kind of slapstick.
Right, and despite then, being the end of the world.
I'm sorry?
Despite being about the end of the world.
Yeah. And then I think that got integrated into the formula for like the last few movies in a way that was really, really, really appealing. I was going to disagree with what you said earlier about Iron Man being a fringe comic book hero.
Oh, pre...
As somebody who was like a big Iron Man aficionado.
So there were certainly people who liked Iron Man well enough, but if you ask kind of the average person, again, pre the Iron Man movie, what Marvel heroes do you know?
Yeah.
Spider-Man,
yeah.
right? Hulk, maybe Fantastic Four.
Spider-Man.
Maybe, but Spider-Man.
X-Men.
Right? They might know the name X-Men, but they're not going to know.
Yeah.
You start getting down into specifics and they're not going to know. And same thing with the Avengers. Like, if they have heard of the Avengers, yeah, they're going to know Hulk and they're probably not going to know anyone else. But these movies, I mean, largely for copyright reasons, because their big names were already locked up with Fox and with Paramount or whoever made the awful Fantastic Four movies. They had to use what they had available, and there were these more obscure characters. I mean, would you ever have thought a Guardians of the Galaxy movie would have been good?
You know, so I didn't read that comic at all. We just watched that. Kind of the fun thing is that my son is now sort of old enough and kind of interested that we like... So this is what we do as a family.
Sure.
So, like, we actually watched the first Iron Man movie a little while ago, which is just a great movie.
It is.
And then we just watched Guardians of the Galaxy, which is also a pretty good movie. And, like, we're keeping him from some of the gnarlier movies. But
Like what? In the Marvel universe?
Yeah, I mean, like, so he's actually kind of seen bits of Infinity War, but, like, I just don't want him sitting down and seeing, like, the monsters and, yeah, just some of the darker ones.
That's fair.
Okay, so somehow we managed to integrate a 10-minute conversation about the Marvel movies.
Right.
Yeah, but that's all about leisure. So...
Our episode on hard work, Marvel movies, and whatever it was we were talking about at the beginning, right?
Yeah. So, go off, work hard today. Watch a Marvel movie with your family. Wash, rinse, and repeat. Okay, so you just wasted another perfectly good hour listening to the City of Man podcast. We are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. To learn more about the network in general, you can go to christianhumanist.org. If you want to interact with COIL, see us post... occasionally posts interesting articles that we read, check out and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Alternately, you can email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And please rate us on iTunes. That helps other people like our show. I actually haven't checked to see if people have been rating us recently. But go there. Like our Facebook page. We really enjoy interacting with our listeners. And as always, let me remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks a lot for listening, y'all. Bye.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking, that ribbon of high...